support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway.
Ken Vogel, retired commander of the United States Navy, a veteran of the Vietnam War, is a CB.
I'm a retired Navy commander, and I spent some time in the Seabees.
Tell us about the Seabees, and even here in the California coast, near Ventura, you have a detachment at Point Mugu.
The detachment is actually at Port Hueneme.
Oh, right.
Which is now part of Naval Base Ventura County. But when I was active duty, it was the home of the Pacific CB battalions.
And CB stands for?
Well, it's really quite a clever acronym. If you take a construction battalion, take the first two letters, CB, and then use that to form a word, S-E-A-B-E-E-S. And then you got a nice, cute logo of a busy bee.
And that's the most visually identifiable thing. When you see that little CB bumblebee with his machine gun, you know.
It is. It reflects the different tools of the trade if you look at that CB's hands. He's got a wrench and a hammer and maybe a saw.
It's really interesting. Back in the Vietnam War, on the nightly news, you saw the infantry and the F-104s coming in, but you rarely saw the CBs at work. And they were fighting a very different war. It was the hearts and minds, correct?
Yes, but first let me tell you a little bit about how the CBs were created, because I think it leads to this. In World War II, the military soon recognized that they couldn't send civilians over to build the bases in the Pacific and even in Germany, because the Geneva Conventions didn't apply.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so they came up with the idea, well, let's enlist a bunch of tradesmen and give them military ranks and then send them over to do the building, because then those people are covered. They also can fight. And so the role of the Seabees became building and fighting. And they were attached to the units that went in everywhere. They participated in the fighting, but they primarily went in first to build the bases and the roads and the airfields. And so that's how they got started, and they served throughout the Pacific and throughout Germany.
That's interesting. Your time in Vietnam was different than what somebody might imagine. You know, Cam Ranh Bay, Da Nang was already built. So you guys built schools, and you built bridges and basic infrastructure in villages. It was very different, quote, war.
Well, I saw both sides of that war. My first tour was in 69, and we were still building the bases in 69. Uh-huh. I was attached to a battalion, Mobile Construction Battalion 8, and we built a lot of the runways in Da Nang. We built the aircraft revetments and shelters. We built just about everything for the troops. Now, in 69, you recall Richard Nixon became president, and, of course, Congress was dead set on ending the war. Nixon created what was called the Vietnamization Program, which was a way to turn over the fighting to the Vietnamese in anticipation of a settlement. So what happened then, starting in 69, they started creating pacification programs. And the CB teams, which I had one of, became the unit that was attached to really a conglomerate. It's very hard to describe the command structure at that time. It was called CORDS, the Civilian Office of Rural Development, and it included elements of the CIA, the Army, the Navy, you name it. They were part of CORDS.
A euphemism for that time and place was hearts and minds.
Yes, it was hearts and minds, and the object was to win over the hearts and mind of the Vietnamese. Most people don't realize it, but in 68, the Viet Cong had their last go. They were through. In 69, all you had were the NVA coming in. But the Viet Cong were basically beaten. And so instead of having a lot of revolutionaries in the country, you had people who perhaps were ripe to be given freedom. And so that was our object. The Seabees then, the teams, which had before supported the special forces during construction, were now attached to advisory teams.
Did you do all your logistics and load your equipment in Ventura?
We did. In 69, when I came home from the battalion, I was allowed to pick the best men from the battalion for my team because 8 was decommissioned. So we were transferred to MCB-4, which was a Pacific battalion. And we did our team training in Port Hueneme. There's a CB training center right there.
Today?
Oh, it's still there.
Yeah.
So we did our training there for 5 months, and then we were loaded onto jets out of Point Magoo, and all of our equipment came by ship. Remember, you have a naval base at Port Hueneme, and then you have a major airfield at Point Magoo, which will handle the C-141.
The Starlifter.
Yeah, the battalions left on the Starlifters originally. Now, we had, as a team, which is a much smaller unit, and I'll tell you a little bit about what a team is. The teams had special equipment. Those were called airlifts. If you visualize a grader, maybe half the size of a normal grader was an airlift grader.
So everything could fit on board an aircraft.
That's right. And typically, it would fit into a Caribou, which is the smallest heavy-lift aircraft that you've got. And Caribous could land almost anywhere in Vietnam. I should tell you what a team is. Most people probably have never heard of a CB team, let alone a CB. Well, a team, as I said, they started out to support Special Forces camps early in Kennedy administration. But they evolved, and they were a small 13-man group. One civil engineer corps officer like me, a junior guy, but with a tour behind him, so he knew a little bit. And then a chief petty officer, an E-7. And then you had one or two of every trade, from an engineering aide, a surveyor, equipment operators, equipment maintenance, carpenters, steel worker. And we also had a hospital corpsman. We called him the doc. So that made up the team.
So even though you were the boss, there were times when you were running a trowel and cutting rebar, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. On a small team, everyone carries their share of the work, including the officer in charge. So when I wasn't doing administrative work, I was out building with the men. And another thing, we all stood watch. We stood 1 and 3 because you got a real small team. So every third night, you didn't get any sleep, but you had to go to work just the same.
So you had M16 or what?
We were fully armed. The teams had a sector of the perimeter that they were responsible for, and it was the front line. So we had an M60 machine gun. We had a mortar. I think it was a 60 millimeter. We each had M16s, shotguns for close in. In addition, the OIC and the chief carried a pistol, you know, the 1911.
45.
The old standard 45. Now, the camp had a moat around it, and we had Claymore mines, hand-activated Claymore mines.
Manually?
Manually.
Interesting. Yeah. Did you ever have incoming mortar attacks where you were based?
Yes, we did. We had mortar attacks all the time. They never hit the CB compound, but what kept a lot of it off, there was a battery of howitzers nearby, which kept us awake all night, of course. We didn't sleep anyway. But,
right.
But these howitzers would fire because there were NVA battalions within miles, several miles of us all around, and they were constantly probing. In addition, the advisory team was running patrols to keep them at bay. But it was a hot situation still. Even though the Viet Cong were left, the NVA were still there.
Did you rotate back and then go into another tour?
I did. My first tour was with the battalion, MCB-8. I was a company officer and then a detachment officer. Then I came back to home port. I went through the CB team training then for 4 months. And we went to SEER training, survival, escape, resistance, and evasion. It teaches you how to deal with a prisoner of war situation. And there was a real risk that we might be captured. So once we left home port, we deployed for 9 months as a team. Then the team came back. I actually went back for a third tour in 71.
And that was choice?
My choice. And the teams were all volunteers. In fact, I volunteered for all three tours. The third tour was an easy tour. It was with the officer in charge of construction in Da Nang. Not Da Nang, Saigon. You know, I could tell you about that one, but that's not as exciting.
On your first deployment, what rank were you, and how fast did you make rank?
I unfortunately was an ensign, you know, and everyone hates to be an ensign.
Because?
Why? Because ensigns know nothing. I came out of the Berkeley ROTC unit, and I had military training. But still, you go in, and your chiefs have 10 years on you, at least 10, maybe 20.
You had World War II guys that were still.
I had one World War II guy,
my
utilities man, Harry. Once you finished the team training, what you did is deployed to a site in California and did a practice project. And so we built a bridge up at Vandenberg. We set up a strongback tent, did all those things, built that little bridge. And then we had some practice working as a team before we deployed.
It is fascinating to me because the Seabees don't normally get the glory. I think John Wayne did one movie in World War II about the fighting Seabees.
Yeah, that's true. You know, that was hyped up in order to sell the Seabees.
But in a normal day-to-day operation, they don't get the...
Well, it depends. It depends. You know, in Da Nang, when I was there, we did come under fire a bit. But the reason we came under fire was we were with either a Marine unit or an Army unit, and they were really shooting for them. And they would miss and shoot over them and hit us, you know.
So you were collateral damage? Then.
We were collateral damage. And Seabees died, but nowhere near the kind of casualty that you have with a normal military.
Well, then you just even have construction accidents.
Well, we did, you know. Yeah. One time a guy dropped a trailer hitch on his finger. And I had to medevac him, called in a chopper, and they took him out of the team compound and patched him up. I got a staph infection. I had a cutaway part of one finger. So, you had things like that.
Mm-hmm.
You had people get sick. Now, we all took malaria pills, but people still would get sick. And then there were casualties of divorce, you know. I had a guy that I let him go back because his wife divorced him.
Oh, interesting.
Towards the end of the tour, and I replaced him. I should tell you something about the projects we did there.
Yeah, do.
Well, the team develops its own workload, really. The officer in charge, like me, deals with the village chiefs, the Vietnamese. And you go out and you talk to them about what they need in their little village. Then, if the project gets approved, the material comes from USAID. And some of it is siphoned off by the chiefs for their own use. But most of it gets through. So our biggest project had been developed by the team before us. They left us a nice open lot, and we built a 6-room schoolhouse, which was a fairly good-sized project for a team. And we completed it in 9 months from the ground up. Reinforced concrete beams. In fact, I designed a lot of the steel for that because they gave us this old French rebar. The form lumber was like crooked like this because it was uncured. So that was a challenge. And everything you build over there, the mud is about 18 inch thick. So anything you build that has any weight to it, you have to use what's called a tram pile. And it's about 6 or 8 feet long stick. And you push it down in the mud as far as you can. And maybe 36 of these on a big footing. That gives you enough bearing. So we put in, you know, those foundations, poured the slabs and did the walls and put the roof on. We trained Vietnamese to help us.
I saw your photos. They were very much an embedded part of your team.
There was another interesting program they came up with. It was called the Chu Hoi program, which meant open arms. And the idea was to take former Viet Cong and make them into builders. They would go through a, what would you call it? Sanitation program that the Army put them through.
Uh-huh.
And by the end of that, hopefully, you know, they were normal people we could count on. And so they gave them to us then, and we trained them to be all the trades that we had. And we used them to help us build a school.
And you did more than schools. You did waterworks and bridges, right?
We did bridges. Mm-hmm. The old French Eiffel bridges often were blown by the Viet Cong. So we would go in and restore them and use either a Bailey Bridge or build something
kind of a rector set.
Right? They were. I wanted to tell you about an interesting incident. The biggest risk that the team ended up facing had to do with a battle between local people.
Within the community.
Within the community.
Ah, interesting.
Because there were so many little factions of Vietnamese. The regional and popular forces was one group. Mm-hmm. And then you had the civilian irregular defense group was another group. But anyway, they got into a fight over a woman. It kept escalating to guns and then mortars and then machine guns.
Wow.
And our camp happened to be in the middle of the fire line.
This is a community fighting each other.
That's right.
Wow.
You think it would be the enemy, right?
Yeah.
Here's the friendlies. And so our camp was riddled with bullets, but nobody got killed. You know, uh-huh. Nobody got hit except a guy had a bullet through his helmet. And I was working on a bridge, and all of a sudden I saw a bunch of rounds coming up the river toward me, splashing through the water. So we ran and hid behind a bank, you know, and thought, we didn't know what was going on. We
right.
thought maybe the enemy was coming. But that's the worst incident that happened to the team while we were there. So when we finished the deployment, the village chief gave us an award, and we got a couple medals. Those medals mean more to me than the U.S. medals that I got.
That's very touching. Symbolizes
it was,
that.
Because it was the hardest tour that I had, mm-hmm. and it reflected something, you know, that we really did for the country, personally. Mm-hmm.
But what a different side of war, you know, where you guys are building stuff and making
right.
stuff. And helping communities.
It was a little odd even, you know, for that time. Now it wouldn't be considered that odd. They're using the military for a lot of things. But, yeah, the military sort of became absorbed into a big conglomerate that was trying to turn the war over. Of course, we all know what happened after
yeah.
that.
Did you ever go back to Vietnam in later years?
No.
Have you ever thought about it?
I have thought about it. I thought I would like to go back. I'd like to see that school we built.
I was thinking about that, if it's still there, and I bet it is because you
it is.
Build it so much rebar and concrete.
No, I got reports back several years ago. See, we built it so we could put a second story on.
I wondered why it had that concrete roof on it.
That's right. We extended mm-hmm. the rebar up, and you see little posts sticking up. Well, darn if they didn't add a second story to
oh,
it.
Oh, cool.
So, yeah. Mm-hmm. Probably now it's a 12-room schoolhouse.
So it would be kind of neat to go back, wouldn't it?
It would be. A lot of men have done that. And I may do that one of these days.
Yeah. I've talked to a couple of Marines that went back, and they were a little skittish about going back, and they were so shocked because that was so many years ago that the young people there don't even, it's like ancient history to them.
You know? Well, I mean, Da Nang Airfield that mm-hmm. we helped build mm-hmm. is an international airport. When I worked for the airport authority years later, a mm-hmm. delegation from Da Nang came out, and I had the opportunity to host them. They gave me a nice picture and everything, but that was rewarding to see that.
After you came back on your last tour of duty, what did you do?
Well, I came back to Naval Air Station Alameda, and I was married to a Vietnamese woman that I met. Now, the marriage didn't last, so I'm not going to tell you too much about it. But I came back to Naval Air Station Alameda, and I was an engineer in public works. And at that time, Alameda was a going concern. Two aircraft carriers. Of course, none of that is there now. And I had a tour there, and then I was picked up for graduate school at Berkeley. I went back.
In engineering?
Construction engineering.
Mm-hmm.
Got a master's. And then after that, I went to Concord Naval Weapons Station as a public works officer.
Which is gone now.
Which is also gone.
Yeah.
I mean, everything is gone yeah. around here. Mare Island Naval Shipyard?
Yeah.
I don't think that's there either.
It's a museum, I think.
Yeah. Moffett? Maybe. Maybe Moffett is still there.
I think it's more NASA, but it's definitely still yeah. there, yeah.
But at that time, it was a military town.
So Concord Weapons Station, that's like, they're doing mega housing development there on that land.
Well, we were busy shipping nukes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had a railroad that we ran, just like the old-style railroad with the big crew of black men doing the hammers and everything. And this little railroad carried the nukes down to Port Chicago, which during World War II blew up. You may have heard there was a big protest that stopped that railroad later on.
Was that anti-war protest?
Yeah, anti-war people stopped that railroad for a while, and they were all... This happened in the 80s.
It was an anti-nuke protest.
It was an anti-nuke protest. I left in 79, and I went to Guam.
You were still Navy at that time?
Still Navy. I went to the Public Works Center at Guam. We serve all the military bases on the island.
I spent time on Guam.
Did you?
Yeah, and it's so under the radar. I mean, it's kind of like a poor man's Hawaii. You know, a lot of the Japanese secretaries and whatnot will go on holiday there because they can't afford Waikiki.
Even then, you know, the Japanese were the main tourists.
Yeah.
Going to the hotels.
To this day.
And, of course, now a lot of our assets that were in the Philippines are on Guam now.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a going concern. You have a little bit of everything on Guam.
And is the air base still there?
The air base is still there, Anderson. Mm-hmm. During the Vietnam War, a lot of the B-52s flew out of Anderson.
Right. And Navy is still on Guam?
Navy's still very much on Guam. Mm-hmm.
And isn't that funny, too? I mean, I think you got United States Post Office there and a lot of American infrastructure there.
Guam is like a little outpost of America.
Yeah.
And the islanders, of course, have not changed.
Mm-hmm.
Islanders still spend their time eating, mostly eating and having fiestas.
Yeah. The Guamanians, I love it. I was with the outgoing governor's wife, spent the day with her, and we talked about spam and how the whole world, Guamanians consume more spam than any other place, by far more than Hawaiians. And Hormel even had to make a special Guamanian spam, hot and spicy.
Well, when they weren't eating fruit bats, they were eating spam. But, you know, the Guamanians absorbed a lot of the things that came in to the commissaries. They'd be there lined up and clean out all the vegetables. And the military wouldn't get a lot of the vegetables because they were already taken. I mean, not that we were bad off. We were fine.
How long were you stationed on Guam?
2 years. It was an accompanied tour. From there, I went to Hawaii to Sinkpak Fleet. And I was what they call a fleet facilities officer. And my job was to fund all the Navy bases in the Pacific. And so I got to make a tour of all the areas, dole out the money.
You were stationed at Pearl?
Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
Right next to Sinkpak Fleet. The Seabees, what's called Pacific Division, it sits up there. They had, at that time, there was an admiral in charge of an outfit called ComNav LogPack. You know, talk about acronyms.
Yeah.
Commander Naval Logistics Command Pacific, something like that. But anyway, they did all of the facilities for fleet.
So you did a lot of logistics stuff then, right?
It was all logistics in Hawaii. But as I say, I traveled all over to all the bases, and I would figure out what they needed, and then I would prioritize the money and get it funded, and they were all happy to see me because I had money.
Yeah. So at some point, you folded your tent for the last time, right?
Two more tours before I folded my tent. From Hawaii, I came back to the Bay Area, and I went to Western Division, which isn't there anymore, and that's another one that was closed.
Where is that base? Where was it?
Western Division was in San Bruno, and I headed an outfit called ROIC Pack, another acronym. Resident Officer in Charge of Construction Pacific. The title sounds bigger than it is. My job was to ship supplies to all the Pacific activities. So that's what I did. You know, I shipped everything they needed in a hurry, and I provided VIP transportation for people coming to town. We had our own shipping department at Oakland Army Base, where all the supplies went out.
And it seems to me that you returned to Ventura at some point. You've been out to the base there.
Not as a military man.
After you retired, then.
Well, I did get back there a couple times after I went to Washington for my last tour. After San Bruno, I went to a job in the Pentagon, which is Op 44. I was 445. ECHO. You laugh at the Navy's acronyms.
Yeah.
But really, my job was Emergency Construction Officer. And so I had to get projects funded for the Navy and Marine Corps that they needed in a hurry. Yeah. And the money wasn't there, by the way. The only way we got the money was by going to Congress and reprogramming money for big projects that hadn't been spent. So I would have to justify this stuff, and then I'd have to talk to the staffers, and they would convince the congressmen to allow them to shift the money to cover this urgent project. And that's how I ended up back at Point Magoo, because I believe it was the F-14 at that time. A bunch of facilities needed right away at Magoo. And so I went out and assessed what they needed and got them some money. And then one time I did a project for the FBI. We built a shooting gallery for the FBI. So it was projects like that. Mm-hmm. And I retired from Washington, and that's why I ended up in Washington.
And what year did you retire?
It was 1989.
But then you went on and did another career, right?
I had a second career. I was unemployed for 7 days, took a little rest, and I went right to work for the Washington Airports Authority. What I did there is I started out as in their maintenance department, and then I became their building code official. But then the best job, I became their construction manager, which I had for 16 years. So we built the new terminal at National, and we built the Dulles Airport expansion, and we built, well, that whole program, about $4 billion roughly at that time.
Did you ever get out to NASA's museum they have out by the airport there?
I watched them build it. Yeah. Interestingly, that was done by a different outfit. The Airport Authority didn't build it, but I knew the people.
Right.
They were Navy people.
Well, you have National Airport. And it was renamed Reagan.
Reagan. Of course, there is a statue of Ronald Reagan there in the old parking area. We rebuilt the old terminal, which was FDR's terminal. Yeah, he had a secret little room down in that terminal where he used to hide when he would fly. And we had that was right below operations in the old terminal.
Very cool.
I had two fine careers, but I think, you know, if I had to pick the one I liked the most, it was a Navy career. And probably the most exciting job I had was the officer in charge of the CB team. Even though I had jobs that were a lot more important, but still.
But that meant the most to you, most touching.
Yes, it did.
Commander Vogel, what an honor to visit with you.
Well, it's been a pleasure to tell you a little bit about my career.
Thank you so much for sharing.
Oh, you're very welcome, and thanks for the opportunity.
You're welcome.
And go Navy.
There you go. We've been speaking with Ken Vogel, retired commander of the United States Navy, a veteran of the Vietnam War as a CB. I'm your host, Tom Wilmer.
Support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway. With a focus on rural communities, such as Leaper's Fork, not far from Nashville, the Big Backyard journey traverses through Tennessee's southwest quarter, down into Alabama's legendary Shoals region, the mothership of American music. The featured rural community's common thread is historic architecture and a timeless, charming small-town atmosphere, some with a river running through it. The diverse attractions of the featured communities include the amazing Elephant Sanctuary in Hohenwald, where retired circus elephants come to retire in peace, and iconic destinations like Northern Alabama's Shoals region, where you'll find one of America's most iconic Frank Lloyd Wright homes, and two of America's legendary recording studios that have been etching American soundtracks since the early 1960s. For example, Muscle Shoals Sound Studios in Sheffield, Alabama, opened in 1969, instantly started marking up the charts with number one hits by recording artists like the Rolling Stones, Willie Nelson, Wilson Pickett, Linda Ronstadt, Rod Stewart, and Paul Simon. Nashville's Big Backyard's ardent promoters include Mike Wolf, host of History Channel's American Pickers TV series, who provides a surgical contextual lens focused on Nashville's Big Backyard's diverse initiatives. and Liz McLaurin, president of the Land Trust for Tennessee, an equally passionate supporter of Nashville's Big Backyard's greater good elements through the Land Trust Preservation Initiatives. To learn more about the program, log on to nashvillesbigbackyard.org. You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
My name is Roseanne Cash. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. And if I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.